This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. Qatar's foreign minister, who is also the country's deputy premier, was briefly in Afghanistan Sunday, becoming the most senior diplomat to visit the country since the Taliban's takeover on August 15th. A Taliban official tweeted the minister met senior officials of the new Afghan regime, although details of their talks were not disclosed. Qatar has long acted as a mediator on Afghanistan, hosting the Taliban's talks with the United States under former President Donald Trump, and then with the now deposed Afghan government of President Ashraf Ghani. It's also supporting tens of thousands of Afghans who were evacuated in the final weeks of the U.S.-led occupation as they are processed before heading to other nations. No country has yet formally recognized the Taliban government. Only three did during their first rule of the hardline Islamists from 1996 to 2001. Iraq's prime minister became the first foreign leader on Sunday to visit and meet with Iran's president Ibrahim Raisi since the hardliner took office in August. Raisi said Iraq had agreed to waive visas for Iranian pilgrims to Shiite holy sites in Iraq later this month, adding, quote, decisions were also made about the two countries' financial issues that should be adopted. Iraq relies on Iranian gas and electricity, but imports have been irregular recently due to outstanding payments. Iran's state gas company said late last year that it had slashed supplies to Iraq over more than $6 billion arrears, placing Baghdad and other cities at risk of power shortages. Find more on these stories and the rest of the day's news at voanews.com or follow us on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. Pope Francis said on Sunday Hungary could preserve its Christian roots while opening up to the needy, an apparent response to nationalist Prime Minister Viktor Orban's stand that Muslim immigration could destroy its heritage. Francis arrived in Hungary early on Sunday for an unusually short stay that underlines differences with the anti-immigrant Orban. He held a mass for tens of thousands of people in central Budapest. Francis has often denounced what he sees as a resurgence of nationalist and populist movements, called for European unity, and criticized countries that try to solve the migration crisis with unilateral or isolationist actions. Later on Sunday, Francis moved on to Slovakia, where he will stay much longer, visiting four cities before returning to Rome on Wednesday. The trip is the Pope's first since undergoing major surgery in July. Francis told reporters on the plane taking him to Budapest that he was, quote, feeling fine. Belarus's strongman president Alexander Lukashenko on Sunday praised Russian and Belarusian troops for their readiness to jointly defend the two countries as he oversaw massive military drills that have spooked some European countries. Russia and Belarus launched military drills on Friday involving about 200,000 personnel, one of Moscow's biggest exercises in recent years. Lukashenko says the two countries are ready to counter what he called, quote, hybrid aggression from the West, and he claims troops from Kazakhstan also took part in the drills. On the eve of the exercise, Russian President Vladimir Putin said the drills with Belarus were, quote, not directed against anyone. And Lukashenko struck the same note on Sunday. Soldiers are being deployed in southeastern Spain to join the battle against a major wildfire that is burning for a fourth day. It's destroyed more than 15,000 acres of forest and prompted fresh evacuations, bringing the total number of residents displaced to around 2,000. Fire officials described Sunday earlier as a, quote, key day for bringing the blaze under control. A combination of hot and dry temperatures with strong winds created a perfect storm, turning the blaze that started late on Wednesday into what a regional official described earlier this week as a, quote, hungry monster. Authorities say they do have evidence of arson. Wildfires are common in southern Europe during the hot, dry summer months, but have been particularly numerous around the Mediterranean this year, worsened by the intense August heat waves. Find more on these stories and the rest of the day's news at voanews.com or on the VOA mobile app. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
I think people will go to work. There is not any issue with the coup itself. But, you know, it's unfortunately in the habit of Guineans to go to work. They will take their time.
The Guinean military junta announces plans to meet various groups on different days this week, beginning Tuesday.
All right. I think the government is going to be created in the beginning of 2022, in January 2022.
Morocco's King Mohammed VI appoints Aziz Akhannouch as the new prime minister and tasks him to form a government.
Absolutely. We have no doubt whatsoever that the president's healthy enough to be incarcerated and healthy enough to go through trial.
And South Africa's opposition Democratic Alliance files a petition seeking a court to reverse former President Jacob Zuma's release on parole on medical grounds. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Guinea, the military junta has announced plans to meet various groups on different days this week, beginning Tuesday. A junta spokesman made the announcement on the National State Broadcaster Television late Saturday. The first meeting of the military rulers will be with civil society groups in the West African country. Other groups they plan to meet this week include officials from banking institutions, business organizations, and mining companies. Analysts say the armed forces appear to want to consult leaders of various groups and institutions before announcing their previously declared plans to name a government of national unity. They also say the junta appears to be implementing measures similar to those carried out by the 2009 military government. Attorney Thiano Balde is the president of the board of the Research Institute on Democracy and Rule of Law. He is also a leading member of the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution, a political pressure group. He tells me that members of his group plan to meet with military leaders before deciding their next line of action.
It's difficult to say exactly what will be the outcome of the meeting or the expectation, because we don't know yet what they would like to obtain from this meeting. But I guess it's going to be a kind of dialogue. Later, all of the actors to express their opinion, their proposals about the upcoming transition, how they might probably would like it to be. So we will see once we get there. I hope probably those people who will attend the meeting will be representative, and also people that are credible enough. Because, you know, one of the issues here in Guinea, every time you have a new regime, you have not only the former member of the government, but also their relatives and all the organization related to the government. They try to get involved and hijack, you know, the agenda. I hope that we are not going to have to deal with the same issue once again.
I understand the military junta is encouraging people to begin returning to work from 7:30 a.m. on Monday. Some people laughed it off, saying it's unrealistic, and that there are concerns that people are not going to work because of the recent coup. What is your take on this?
I think people will go to work. There is not any issue with the coup itself. But, you know, it's unfortunately in the habit of Guineans to go to work. They will take their time. In general, they get in their office around 9 or 10 a.m. And after 1 or 2 p.m., they will leave the office. You have really few Guineans who might have, you know, this professional attitude to go on time to work and leave on time. Most of the people, they just act like, you know, working and also they will tell you, since they are not paid enough, there's no need for them to spend so much time in office. So it will make so much effort to change this kind of attitude with the new group at the head of the country.
The military junta also announced a series of meetings throughout the week, including those for senior bank officials, business organizations, mining organizations, and the likes. What do you think they are trying to achieve here?
I guess since they just took over, they would like to listen to each and every of the representant of the Guinean society, the bank, the religious leaders, the political party leaders, the union leaders, and so on. Try to find out what will be their opinion about how the transition should be organized. After that, maybe make a general proposal to set up the different procedures in order to have a working transitional organization. Other than that, I don't think at this stage it will be efficient to discuss about other issues, since we don't have yet any of the organization that might be considered as part of the transition or the national government. So we will wait to see after the meetings.
Since you've seen the communique that the junta has said, some people are suggesting that it looks like the consultation is part of the effort for them to announce a transitional government. What are your thoughts?
No, I don't think we can talk about forming a new government at this stage. Keep in mind, in order to have a government, we have to define, its responsibility during the transition, and also the number of members of the government, how long it will take, and so on. There are so many other issues which should be discussed before, putting in place any government. I think the idea would be more about to get the opinion.
Attorney Thiano Balde is the president of the board of the Research Institute on Democracy and Rule of Law. He spoke with me from the Guinean capital, Conakry. In Morocco, King Mohammed VI has appointed Aziz Akanouche as the new prime minister and tasked him with forming the next government. Akanouche, a successful businessman, is the leader of the Liberal National Rally of Independence, or RNI. The party just won the biggest number of seats in the incoming National Assembly. Its success comes after the ruling Justice and Development Party, or JDP, suffered heavy losses. The JDP's 125 seats were sharply reduced to 12 in the incoming National Assembly. Official figures from last week's parliamentary election show the National Rally of Independence, or RNI, won 97 seats, while the Authenticity and Modernity Party, or PAM, won 82 seats. The centre-right Estikal Party won 78 seats in the 395-seat parliament. Hicham Bensari is a political analyst in the Moroccan capital, Rabat. He tells me that Moroccans expect the newly appointed prime minister to use his private sector experience to help create jobs for the youth. Bensari also says Mr. Akanouche has to implement policies to restore investor confidence to attract both local and international investors.
The person who forms the government, who's heading the government, comes from the biggest party in terms of votes in the country. And RNI is now the first party in Morocco with 102 out of 395, I think, seats in the parliament. So Aziza Khanoush started in 2017, being the president of RNI, and he radically, you know, transformed that party. He structured it as, you know, a company. He's one of the top entrepreneurs in Morocco, comes from the private sector. So he's known to be pragmatic, being an entrepreneur who's also a technocrat and a technician.
But I hear he's very successful. He's a very rich man. What are the expectations of Moroccans of his government if he decides to name it this week?
I mean, Peter, the expectations of the Moroccan people are very, very high. I mean, the Moroccans have been sick and tired of the PJD-led governments for 10 years now. So Moroccans are very, you know, they hope, they put a lot of hope, especially in this context of pandemic, to restart the country. I mean, the economy, the youth, people want jobs, they want, you know, a performing economy, and all the infrastructure and all the basics are here, you know.
I understand the RNI got a sizable vote from the country's youth, who they argue have high unemployment rate, and they expect the economy to perform better, for jobs to be created, for them to be employed. If the government is formed within the next few days or weeks to come, what do you think are the expectations of the youth?
All right. I think the government is going to be created in the beginning of 2022, in January 2022. I mean, in general, you know, the elections are taking place in September, and, you know, the government is taking at least 2-3 months to form, you know, the negotiations. And so maybe this time is going to be faster, because, I mean, at least here it's clear, pretty high in normal periods, and this one, in this period, is even higher. The problem with Morocco is that we don't create enough jobs for the youth, and it creates a brain drain. You know, people emigrate, try to go to other countries in order to find jobs. And this tendency needs to be reversed. I mean, as far as you're saying, the RNI and its president, Mr. Akhnouch, he's been very successful as being an entrepreneur and creating jobs in his own companies. And he's got the formula of, you know, private sector-led job creation that is highly needed, because, I mean, as far as I know, in Morocco, it's not only a problem of unemployment, but it's also, you know, a problem of underemployment. Industry and trade strategy that was started maybe 15 to 20 years ago. First, in the automobile industry. So, and even went, you know, in the first position ahead of South Africa. There was a new...
Hisham Bensari is a political analyst in Morocco. He spoke with me from the capital, Rabat. In South Africa, the opposition Democratic Alliance says it has filed a petition seeking a court to reverse former President Jacob Zuma's release on parole on medical grounds. The party contends that the former president is healthy enough to serve the entire 15-month penalty in jail. A constitutional court ordered the sentence when Mr. Zuma refused to testify before an anti-graft commission investigating allegations of corruption during his presidency. The opposition party also wants the court to grant the group access to the medical record used to justify his release. But supporters say the former leader is tired of doubt about his health. They reject the DA's court petition, saying it is yet another attempt by the party to persecute Mr. Zuma. For more about the opposition party's court petition, I reach parliamentarian Natasha Wendy Anita Mazon, chief whip of the Democratic Alliance in South Africa's National Assembly.
Well, the reason behind the court application is because we have a very stringent process that one has to go to get medical parole in South Africa. And the only person who can grant such medical parole, Mr. Arthur Fraser, has come out publicly and said that he was not involved in the granting of the parole and that it was given incorrectly. As such, we require the exact same treatment that any other South African would receive, and Mr. Jacob Zuma will then have to face a public doctor just like any other South African would, and that doctor would then advise the parole board as to whether or not he would be able to receive the medical leave. So the whole process has been flawed ab initio, and we would like it to start afresh ab initio.
Are you therefore doubtful about the medical records upon which the decision was made to release the former president on the medical parole?
Absolutely. We have no doubt whatsoever that the president is healthy enough to be incarcerated and healthy enough to go through trial.
So why are you seeking to have access to the medical records? What's the rationale behind it?
Well, the rush behind it is that a man who should be behind bars is now not behind bars, and South African legislation says that the medical reason need not be given. Now, we're talking about someone who has over 227 charges of corruption against his name, and the entire country is now looking to the courts to make this decision, and we think it is fair that the country sees the medical records and the reasons that he's given for not being willing to stand trial.
The court has yet to set a date to hear your case, but how soon do you think you will know of when the court will make a decision for this case to proceed?
We think we will know very soon, as we've submitted it as an urgent court application.
So what's the next line of action if the court begins hearing this case for the DA?
Well, the court will hear the case, and the court will then call Mr. Arthur Fraser, who is the person who can grant this kind of parole. The court will also hear from certain doctors, and the court will hear from also medical officials and jailers who were in charge of him during his time in incarceration as to the state of his well-being. And that case will be heard. It will be done, as all cases in South Africa are, out in the open, and we'll take it from there.
Some supporters of the former president have expressed concern that the former president is tired of being doubted about his health condition. Some say the man is not feeling well and that he should be left alone, but this is yet another attempt by the Democratic Alliance to persecute him in that directive. How do you respond to such criticism?
Like we respond to all the criticism we receive from the president's supporters in the past. The president has begged for his day in court. He now finally has the chance, and he's doing everything in his power not to have his day in court. Just like any other South African, if you have done something wrong, you face the might of the law, and ex-president Jacob Zuma is not above the law in any way.
Parliamentarian Natasha Wendy Anita Mazon is the chief whip of the Democratic Alliance in South Africa's National Assembly. She spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. The Botswana Federation of Public, Private and Parastatal Sector Unions, or BOFEPUSU, says the arrest of Pastor Thuso Tiego is unacceptable and unfortunate. Mr. Tiego was briefly arrested and released as the police continue its investigation. The pastor launched a solo protest demanding the resignation of President Mokgweetsi Masisi. He accuses the president of mismanaging the economy, which he says has resulted in high youth unemployment.
Supporters of the government dismiss his resignation demand as a publicity stunt. They say the pastor appears angry that his attempts to reach the office of the president have been unsuccessful. Babofepusu says his arrest violates his fundamental human rights and the constitution, which guarantees freedom of expression. Ketel Halefile Motewa is the deputy secretary general of Bofepusu. He tells me the arrest and subsequent release of the pastor defies his constitutional rights and the provision that guarantees free speech.
Bofepusu calls on government of Botswana to respect freedom of expression and conscience, respect the right to peaceful assembly and demonstration. Democracy provides an environment that respects human rights and fundamental freedoms, and in which the freely expressed will of the people is exercised. These values are embodied in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The idea and concept of democracy includes human rights, as democracy is built on the fundamental of human rights. In front of all, on the democratic principle as part of human rights. Therefore, the respect of human rights is part of a democratic system. Human rights are the frame of reference for democracy. Now these values are being eroded from our republic as government tramples upon the rights of the people in an attempt to instill fear on them. It's an epoch of state unleashing terror on its people, and therefore prevalence of state terrorism. There is fear of the country disintegrating into a police state.
Lafile, the pastor has been released. So what is there again to talk about?
Our issue is that even though the pastor has been released, the police and the prosecution authorities have indicated to him that they are still making further investigations and that they will come back to him with specific charges. And the broader concern is that we are witnessing a situation whereby now government is shrinking the political space for citizens to participate. And if this not is kept, so we are worried and fearful that things might get worse.
What do you say to those who are of the opinion that this is not the time for protest and that he could have done so virtually by demanding the resignation of the president as he is doing now, instead of going on demonstration in the street, putting people's life at risk?
The pastor had made it clear that it's a one-man walk. So he had cautioned and advised people not to join him, as will be working on their behalf in calling for the resignation of the president. And I don't think the issue of COVID-19 protocol arises, because the COVID-19 protocols are such that people up to the number 50 can congregate into a meeting. But in this case, he had decided to make it a one-man walk, and it falls within the COVID-19 protocols. And he was simply saying he will be walking or marching to the office of the president, which should be acceptable.
But supporters of the government have denied that there is an orchestrated attempt to stop people from freely expressing their opinion or protesting or freedom of speech. How do you respond to that?
Well, that is the nature of government. They will always deny things that they are doing. So we can't expect them to come out and accept their wrongdoing. But the reality is that the political space is shrinking. There are many instances and incidents where now people are being arrested just for exercising their rights. And we are saying people must be allowed to exercise their right to freedom of assembly, freedom of association, freedom of conscience, and other freedoms under the Bill of Rights.
But what do you say to those who are saying that your group has become political instead of staying neutral as you are supposed to?
No, we can't be neutral. We always say labor movement, there's a role to play in the socio-economic and political sphere of the country. Labor movement have a role to play in public policy, to influence the laws of the country, the policies of the country, to ensure that they are friendly to the workers and the poor. So we can't be bystanders in the political economy of the country. We have a role to play to protect democracy of this country, to fight corruption, to hold leaders accountable for their deeds and misdeeds.
Kethalefile Motsenwa is the Deputy Secretary General of the Botswana Federation of Public, Private and Parastatal Sector Unions, or BOFEPUSU. He spoke with me from the capital, Habaroni. The United Nations Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, says Cameroon continues to be one of the world's most neglected displacement crises, with refugee needs increasing far more quickly than our available resources. The Central African nation is home to about 500,000 refugees, most of them having fled the troubled Central African Republic and Boko Haram terrorism in Nigeria. For VOA Moki, Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Rauf Mazu, the United Nations Refugee Agency Assistant High Commissioner for Operations, says this week he met with humanitarian agencies and Cameroonian government officials, including Prime Minister Joseph John Gute, to look at ways to reinforce humanitarian actions to help displaced persons and refugees. In August, countries surrounding Lake Chad reported an increase in the number of people displaced in Chad, Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Nigeria, and Niger. Cameroon said at least 1,500 former Boko Haram militants have arrived on its northern border with Nigeria since May, when Abubakar Shekau, leader of the Islamist group, was declared killed. Cameroon also reported that more than 40 villages were razed and 10,000 citizens fled northern Cameroon to Chad after a violent conflict between herders and fishers in August. Mazu visited Cameroon's far north region on the border with Nigeria and Chad. He met 4,000 displaced people in the northern border village of Zamai. Mazu says they desperately need civil registration documents so they can integrate into their new communities.
There is one thing that I think is essential is the issue of civil registration. They kept on repeating the same. They kept on saying that our children are here, they cannot go to school. When we ask why can't they go to school, one of the key reasons why we don't have documents for them. Of course, there is also the issue of the cost. Even if primary education is free, people do have to pay an amount of money. But the issue of documentation for them is absolutely crucial.
Speaking to local media, including Cameroon State broadcaster CRTV, Mazu said there are more than 1 million displaced Cameroonians in the country. UNHCR says Cameroon, with a population of 26 million, is also home to about 500,000 refugees and asylum seekers. Among the refugees, 120,000 are Nigerian citizens fleeing Boko Haram terrorism, and 321,000 are fleeing violence caused by the political tensions in the Central African Republic. Cameroon says other refugees are from Chad, Senegal, Mali, and Niger. Xavier Bourgeois is UNHCR spokesperson in Cameroon. He says UNHCR has limited means to help people seeking refuge.
Pour porter assistance, mais aussi mettre en place les
programmes. He says UNHCR has only 44% of the $100 million it needs to provide emergency humanitarian services for refugees and displaced Cameroonians, and to assist host communities that share their already stretched resources with displaced people. In February, Cameroon said 5,000 of the 120,000 Nigerians, mostly women and children, who fled across the border from Boko Haram terrorists have agreed to voluntarily return to Nigeria. The UNHCR says about 4,500 Nigerians have returned. The remaining are still worried about their security should they return to Nigeria. Several thousand Central African Republic refugees have also returned to their country. Cameroon says a majority are still scared of insecurity and violence after the December general elections there. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. But first, it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The CAF Champions League 2021-2022 kicked off officially on Friday with the opening two matches of the first preliminary round. Uganda's Express Football Club beat Al Merrikh of Sudan 2-1, and AmaZulu FC of South Africa lost 1-0 to Nyasa Big Bullets of Malawi. On Saturday, Royal Leopards of Eswatini beat Zesco United of Zambia 1-0. UD Dusong of Mozambique beat Otoho Duoyo of Congo 1-0. As Ata of Djibouti drew with the Tusk of Kenya 1-1, Stade Malien of Mali were winners against Sonabel of Guinea-Bissau 1-0. FC Lotto Benin drew 1-1 with Nouadhibou of Mauritania. Fortune of Gambia beat ES Satif of Algeria 3-0, and ASEC Mimosa of Ivory Coast beat Tengwes of Senegal 1-0. Meanwhile, the World League Forum, WLF, the Association of Professional Leagues, has rejected the idea of a biannual World Cup. The World Football Governing Body, FIFA, is holding a feasibility study into a biannual men's and women's tournament. But WLF says that arrangement would dilute the historical and traditional values of the World Cup. In their statement, WLF says a biennial World Cup would negatively disrupt the football economy and undermine players' welfare in a calendar that is already overloaded. The Men's World Cup has been held every 4 years since the inaugural tournament in 1930, except in 1942 and 1946 because of World War II. In the Diamond League final in Zurich, Burundi's Francine Niyonsaba beat Kenyan rival Hellen Obiri to win the 5,000 meters title. The 28-year-old, who was disqualified from the 5,000 meters heats at Tokyo 2020, proved too strong in the home stretch, winning in 14 minutes 28.98 seconds. Niyonsaba used specialized in 800 meters, but switched events after testosterone limits were introduced in 2018. Meanwhile, Namibia's 18-year-old Olympic silver medalist Christian Mboma improved her world under 2200 meters record to 21.78 seconds to win the final at the Diamond League on Thursday. Jamaica's Sherika Jackson finished second, and Great Britain's Dina Asha Smith was third, while Swiss star Mujinga Kobunji came fourth. Still in athletics, the Kip Keino Classic, a World Athletics Continental Tour Gold Meeting, will be held in Nairobi, Kenya on September 18th. Athletes from at least 28 countries are expected to compete at the Kasarani Stadium, which recently hosted the World Athletics Under-20 Championships. Olympic 1500 meters champion Kenya's Kipigion, Uganda's Olympic 3000 meters steeplechase champion Chemutai are among the athletes to compete. Also, Morocco's Salfan Al-Bakali has been announced for the men's race alongside Kenya's World Under-20 champion Amos Serem. In the men's 100 meters action will be the U.S.'s world leader Trayvon Bromell, Kenya's record holder Ferdinand Omanyala, and U.S.'s Justin Gatlin, while Botswana's Isaac Makwala has been announced for the 100 meters. Namibia's Christine Mboma also returns to Nairobi, where the 18-year-old won the World Under-20 title just last month. And that's about it for this edition of Nathan Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Here we go again. Last week, the Guinean Colonel Tumbuya announced that the Guinean army are taking control of the Guinean government. The constitution has been suspended. The incumbent president, Alpha Conde, was under arrest and then announced that the mining industries on which the Guinean economy depends should continue. Also announced that there would be no witch hunt and that the people should remain calm. Following this, Colonel Tumbuya summoned all the ministers and assured them that they would not be armed, authorized them not to leave the country, and requested them to surrender their passports. They were then asked to go back to their families. Thus far, it would appear that the people of Guinea appear to tolerate this military coup. No close observer of developments in Africa or in Guinea, for that matter, could pretend that the military intervention in Guinea came as a surprise. No one could question the fact that the people of Africa are sick and tired of military coup d'etats. Yet, they happen. This is the time for very deep and dispassionate research instead of flim-flam analysis trying to explain the circumstances that led to the coup in Guinea. For some time now, political scientists and those studying government have felt that the best way to stop military coups is to give the people of the African continent and their countries to choose their own government. The African security and political institutions, such as the African Union and the regional sub-regional organs, have been able to set the standard that all African governments should respect the time limits of their constitution. Let me say, we are not talking about those African countries which, for one reason or another, may not have a time limit. But where they have a time limit like 2 years, the African institution must insist that incumbent executive presidents keep their obligations to vacate office at the end of the term. What we have seen, however, is that the African institutions like the African Union and regional organizations have not been able to tackle the clever maneuver that incumbent presidents have adopted to evade their obligations. Firstly, as we saw with the former president of Burundi, they have used their constitutional courts, which they control, to interpret the obligation, and they have extended their stay. Secondly, as it was in the DRC with Kabila, he used both the constitutional court and the electoral commission to get around his obligation. First, the election commission said they could not hold the election on time, and then the constitutional court argued that having failed to have election, there could be no vacancy or vacuum, and then Kabila was able to extend his time in office way beyond the time limit. Another clever maneuver is to conduct referenda, as we saw in Rwanda, saying the people have decided to ignore the time limit and they have extended their stay. The consequences of these maneuvers and the lack of reaction from our institutions, OAU, the African Union, and the sub-regional organization, has meant that the people of their countries have become very, very feeling helpless. What could they do if their incumbent presidents make these maneuvers with no consequences? This is why the coup in Guinea is of no major surprise. Luckily for us, thus far, the coup has remained bloodless. But no one can tell what the future holds. No one will also question the suspension of Guinea by both ECOWAS and the African Union. But this is not the real answer. How do you prevent these maneuvers? We have a situation in the early 90s in Mali when General Tumani made a coup in March 1991, but quickly turned over the government to civilians in June the following year. So the problem now is to urge the leaders, the military leaders in Guinea, to shut in as much as possible their stay in government, agree for a fair and realistic period of transition, and then quickly arrange for elections, fair, level-headed election, and also have a new election of the people in Guinea. I thank you.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Sarukume, 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 Sarukume,
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor William Eagle, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Nadia Taha, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, to get rid of anger, first weed out the bitter root. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.